How many different types of literature are contained in our Bibles? And should we read or interpret them all in exactly the same way? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author, and we're continuing our quarter study on how to interpret the Bible, how to understand what the Scripture says. My conversation partners throughout this quarter are Dr. Dave Thomas and Dr. Carl Kozart, my colleagues at the School of Theology. And we're in an interesting quarter where we are all quarantined, and we hope that you're staying safe, and we hope these studies of the Bible help you through in some small ways, maybe in some big ways as well. Dave and Carl, I'd love to know from you, how many different types of literature are there in the Bible, or is it just one main type and we all interpret all of it the exact same way?
There's a variety of different types of genres in the Bible. I mean, poetry would be one. Poetry is read very different than a narrative account or an apocalyptic account, something like we would see in the book of Revelation or the prophecies in the book of Daniel. So there would be three right at the top of my head. We can mention law also would be another category.
You have just plain historical records.
Historical records, law, narratives, genealogies. If we wanted to break some of these down into subgroups, we have genealogies mentioned. We have wisdom literature.
Parables, for example, would be another category.
You have some fables.
Say more about that, Dave. What do you mean fables?
Well, I think you have some stories that have illustrative and explanatory value, but they're not historically true. I think Jesus used a very famous one, the story of the rich man and Lazarus.
Yeah, Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18. Yeah, that's the story.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there's some philosophy that Paul quotes. He quotes from philosophers. That's a different category, but there's all kinds of literature.
We could also mention, you mentioned Paul, that would be epistles. So epistles are certainly read a different way than we'd read a parable.
Yeah. Is this part of the area that we get into trouble as Christians when we try and interpret Paul, for instance? We interpret some of Paul's letters the same way we might interpret Jewish law. Or when we look at the New Testament, we read the epistles. Should we be reading Paul's letters as if they are a new law for Christians? I've heard both ideas put forth. One, that Paul should never be equated to law. He's giving kind of directions for what Christian living looks like generally, but never giving actual laws that we should keep. But others have said, no, Paul is speaking the laws of the Spirit for the Christian life. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think you have to certainly recognize the context of Paul's letters. Context, I think, provides a way to really understand what's being said. I think, for example, the passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where Paul talks about head coverings, and a passage certainly where if you were to take it as it reads, per se, then would be saying that women need to wear some sort of head covering when they come to worship. And some people have actually applied that, and that's been a custom in some circles. But if you look at the passage, Paul, I think, clearly there indicates that he's arguing from cultural values at the time to make his point. He's not necessarily endorsing cultural values, but he's using cultural values in order to make his point for a very complex situation with worship in the Church of Corinth.
You know, Brent, I want to say that interpretation is one of the main functions of human life. That anything that comes in any kind of language has to be interpreted, you know, because we have sarcasm, which means the opposite of what it sounds like. We have irony, we have exaggeration, we have all these things that are there to nuance and to finesse meaning, but it's not meaning in it of itself. And so anytime you have something written or spoken, you have to interpret it. Okay. And we as human beings are amazingly adept at doing this. You know, that we somehow read through language, and I like the description of language as an instrument that conveys meaning through which we do business. Okay. Language, we pay no attention to language as long as it's conveying its message. Only when it doesn't convey its message do we worry about language. And so interpretation is something I'm not sure we can fully explain, but it functions every day of our lives.
So you're suggesting that just having a conversation with people, when my son says, I tell him a story and he says, no way, He's not saying he doesn't believe me. He's saying that that's a really neat story. That's amazing. He's not arguing the opposite, right?
And I like what they say in Maine, that that is wicked good.
That is wicked good.
Now, see, those in regular English, it doesn't work, see. And we have figures of speech. When you're talking off the top of your head, what does that mean? You put the words up on the top of your head? I mean, you see, we have to interpret. And so to read the Bible with all its different forms, it's nearly made up of things that are common to human language, and we have to interpret it.
And this suggests also that there are maybe idioms in the Bible that we need to be careful about. One that was pointed out to me at the seminary was speaking of the God of Israel having two long noses. And I had never heard that before. And they took us to the passage when Moses was on Mount Sinai and he asked to see the glory of God. And we were reading it from the Hebrew text. And sure enough, it's God declared his glory before Moses and said, the Lord, gracious and compassionate, long suffering," except the word long suffering was literally in the Hebrew, two long noses. And I thought, where did that come from? And then they explain, no, this is an idiom. When you get mad, your nose gets red and hot. And the longer your nose is, the longer it took you to get angry. And God is not like us. He not only has one long nose, he has two long noses. So if I were to try and interpret that literally, I would be in trouble, wouldn't I?
Yeah, and I think part of the problem we do with the Bible is that we take a comment that we happen to like and then we try to universalize it, like the one Carl mentioned about women wearing hats. You know, we say, oh, there's a rule, let's universalize it. It should apply across the board to everybody in every circumstance when you go to church, which is not the point.
But in today's culture, is it inappropriate to apply that sort of thinking, let's say, to some of the Old Testament and New Testament prohibitions about sexual immorality? Would we say that, hey, immorality, that's a cultural moving target, and I have to be careful? And I know this is a hot topic, and we could get into a lot of deep discussion and over it, but do we argue that things like,
I would say something like that is that, you know, with the passage we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 about head coverings, it's an isolated passage in the context of 1 Corinthians. But when we talk about issues of sexual morality, it's not one text here, two texts, you know, an occasional place. That's a constant theme throughout Scripture, a theme in a sense of a pathway that does not lead to true satisfaction and happiness, and it's not the type of life God created for us. So that's very different than an isolated passage somewhere that might be understood from context, I think.
But I would say also that when you go back to Genesis, it's very clear that sexuality is binary. God made male and females. Yeah. Now, what has happened to it in our day is a completely different question. But, you know, the ideal is still out there to be achieved. And I think that it's a very simple thing to realize that the difference between the actual and the ideal is the zone of human struggle.
And in many ways,
the further we are away from the ideal, the more life becomes difficult.
There's the truth to that. When we stray from God's ideal, we run into problems. But don't we then look at the whole of Scripture, not just the narrative portions, not just the law portions, not just the epistles, but we look at the whole thing, how it informs each other, each passage informs the other to give us kind of a doctrine. Now, Dave, you're a systematic theologian, or a biblical theologian, and thus do some systematics as well. But in a sense, don't we do canonical theology? We look at the whole Bible, right? So if we were to take a subject, let's say like polygamy, I don't know of a law in the Old Testament that says you cannot have more than one spouse. I don't know of one, but is it possible that when I look at the life of the patriarchs, when I look at those in Scripture who in the narratives who did have more than one spouse, I can glean some information from that?
Well, you stumbled into a bit of a hornet's nest there, Brand, because on the continent I grew up in, there are people who will explain to you that polygamy is better because if a parent dies in our society, then a child is bereft. If their mother dies, then they're done in the sense of a motherly influence. In a polygamous society, another wife would just step in and carry on. See, so they will argue that thing back and forth, but my argument would be that it's not the ideal. The ideal is laid out in the early parts of Genesis, and it's one man, one wife, one wife, one husband. So I think that would be the grounds on which I would argue against polygamy.
You might get comfort when a parent dies, but it'd be a sure lot of heartache in the home itself with all your wives, I think. So,
well, yeah, it's a fairly difficult proposition, and the expectations you bring to that kind of arrangement will determine how successful it is.
Well, and it makes me laugh when I think about the proverb that says, better to live on the corner of a roof than with a difficult wife. And it's like, what if you have two or three of them? You might run out of corners of the roof.
Yeah, but what if you have four or five who are happy to associate together?
Sure. Sure. And these are challenges. And so then when I think about the biblical text, when I interpret the stories, I'm not looking just at one story. I'm looking at the whole tenor of scripture. So I go to Genesis, to the creation narrative. I go to the Old Testament narratives. And I do look at the laws of Israel to say, how are they reflecting God's ideal for spirituality tied to sexuality? And then I look at what Jesus teaches as well, right? And what Paul says. In fact, Paul will go so far as to suggest it's better that we stay single entirely, right?
Yep.
Yeah. But I agree with you in principle that you ought to read very broadly in the Bible and not just sort on one thing. Like we've gotten into trouble over the divorce issue because we only picked that one. I think it's in Luke 19 about
the only reason
except for adultery, and we don't realize that there's a context to that that should prevent us from universalizing. I think the real text on divorce is in Malachi 2. God says, I hate divorce.
Yeah. Well, I think the issue with that too, Dave and Brandt, is that just because we find a behavior in the Bible does not mean it's endorsed behavior. So God comes to a broken world, and he works with what he has. And certainly there's an ideal that God desires us to have, but it's not always the ideal when he enters into human time and space.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so the best way to understand these topics then is to really look at all the different genre of scripture. If we talk about this issue of, let's say, human sexuality, and I read the wisdom literature, for instance, I'll read that the wise people, the wise men who wrote the Proverbs over and over said that walking down a path of adultery, down a path of sexual immorality is a path that will bite in the end, right? It will have horrible ramifications. Yeah. Am I allowed to do it? Well, in a sense, I'm free to do it. I'm free to act however I choose, but in the end, there will be ramifications. And we see these things played out in all the different genres. And this is why I think this sort of topic is best understood through all the different genres.
Brian, before you leave that, I want to say that many times the trouble we get into is not because of God acting against us, but because the wrongness of our acts brings its own punishment. It's inherent in the wrongness. So,
I guess if we could leave with one main idea today, and that is the Bible speaks about many topics, but it would be irresponsible for us to interpret any single genre of the Bible. It would be irresponsible to interpret that without looking at the other genres of the Bible, and it would also be irresponsible to apply all the same principles of the one genre to the other. Any closing thoughts here?
Yeah, I think we should be careful not to universalize the things that we like. We should make sure that the Bible universalizes them before we do.
All right. Carl, how about you? Any closing ideas?
I think it's great that God communicates to us in a variety of different forms to help us understand.
It's true. We've been given many genres in the Bible. They're all there for the same purpose. So next week, we'll continue our study of the interpretation of the Bible. My thanks to our conversation partners this week, Dr. Dave Thomas and Dr. Carl Cozart. And for the good word, I'm Brant Berglund. Thanks for listening in.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.